The headlines: Palestinians in the Gaza Strip mark the 35th anniversary of the creation of the resistance movement Hamas. U.S. officials say Washington will soon send a sophisticated Patriot missile system to Ukraine to bolster its air defense against Russian attacks. And the Brazilian president-elect Lula da Silva accuses Jair Bolsonaro of inciting violence one day after the incumbent supporters torched vehicles and clashed with police.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The head of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in Gaza says resistance is the only way to liberate the occupied Palestinian lands. In a speech marking the 35th anniversary of the movement's creation, Yahya Sinwar condemned the regime's aggressive policies against Palestinians. He stressed that the resistance front will continue to fight against those atrocities, but called for unity among Palestinians. Sinwar also slammed some Arab nations for normalizing ties with what he called the apartheid regime. The Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniya also spoke on the occasion and emphasized the movement's unwavering support for and commitment to the Palestinian cause. Hamas was established soon after the first Palestinian uprising broke out against the Israeli occupation. The movement has been administering Gaza since the year 2007, when it scored a surprise parliamentary victory. Every year, Hamas marks the anniversary of its foundation with military parades and rallies. Earlier, correspondent Ashraf Shannon walked us through the mass rally in Gaza on the 35th anniversary of the formation of the Hamas resistance movement.
Well, as tens of thousands of people gathered here in this huge area to rally to mark the 35th anniversary of Hamas's establishment, people from all walks of life came here and stressed the adherence of the Palestinians and the resistance factions to the resistance against the Israeli regime. 35 years ago, Hamas was established based on resistance and Islamic values, and the movement continues to garner support and popularity year after year because of its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime and adherence to armed resistance as the key to the liberation of Palestine. What really is clear today that Hamas reiterated the principles of the Palestinian people. That's the right of return for refugees, the liberation of Al-Quds, the sanctity of Al-Quds, and the extreme importance of defending Al-Quds against the desecration by Israeli settlers and soldiers.
Yemen's Ministry of Health says child malnutrition cases have doubled since Saudi Arabia launched its war on the country. The latest figures show that Yemen has the highest cases of severe malnutrition in the world. Yusuf Mari has more.
Hundreds of thousands of children in Yemen could die from starvation and preventable diseases such as cholera, measles, and child malnutrition. We visited the Sab'een Hospital in the capital, Sana'a, which receives some of the worst cases of child malnutrition in the country. At this hospital, we got a first-hand look at what starvation looks like. Shema is fighting to stay alive. However, her body just doesn't have the nourishment needed to help her breathe normally, according to her doctor. Her family also doesn't have the financial means to give her the proper treatment and nutrients needed.
This patient came here all the way from Hodeida while severely malnourished and showing symptoms like diarrhea and vomiting. This child, according to her parents, was living normally but then started to have severe diarrhea and vomiting because she was not getting the proper nutrition she needed as her family just doesn't have enough money.
Next door is another severely malnourished child. Little Elaf has developed a disorder called pectus carinatum, which causes the chest bone to grow outward.
This child's severe malnutrition has caused her chest to grow unnaturally. As you can see, her chest is taking the form of what we call a bird chest due to the illness.
Yemen's Ministry of Health says that Yemen has the highest number of malnutrition cases in the world, due to the Saudi war and blockade that has crippled the nation's healthcare system.
There are about 4 million Yemeni children and mothers who suffer from malnutrition, according to our latest statistics. 500,000 of these cases are severely malnourished, and 50,000 of these cases are in risk of dying.
Although the Saudi airstrikes have led to the death of tens of thousands of Yemenis, the number one killer in Yemen, according to the health ministry, is the strangling Saudi blockade, which has prevented imports of vital foods, fuel, and drugs to Yemen, leading to the world's worst humanitarian crisis. UN agencies warn that 1 in 5 Yemeni children under the age of 5 are malnourished and in need of urgent care. Medical experts we spoke with also say that Yemeni families are unable to sustain a healthy nutritional diet for their children. That's because families don't receive salaries due to Saudi restrictions. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Iran's southwestern Abadan refinery is the oldest oil refinery in the country. The plant has embarked on a mega project aimed at modernizing its deteriorating equipment. Yusuf Jalali reports from the city of Abadan.
The first oil refinery in the Middle East, located in Iran's southwestern city of Abadan, near the western coast of the Persian Gulf, the Abadan refinery was launched in 1912. However, due to the deterioration of its old plants, it has undergone fundamental renovation since 2005, aiming to optimize the quality of its products and stabilize its processing capacity at 360,000 barrels per day.
We renew or establish some new refinery in two parts. One part with 150,000 barrels per day in more than 15 years ago. Now we established the new phase one with 210,000 barrels. The sum of the phase one and two is 360,000 barrels per day as a new capacity and a new refinery.
The second renovation phase, with a capacity of 210,000 barrels per day, needs 2.6 billion euros to be accomplished. But due to the Western sanctions, the project's financial resources face challenges.
Because of sanctions, we cannot follow, we cannot get the full finance. This finance is break to half the finance or the investment of this project, more than 1 billion euro. Up to now, and in the future, in the next year, we start the phase two or section two of this project to complete the refinery.
All of the products at the new phase of the Abadan refinery will be produced with a Euro 5 standard, which makes them more eco-friendly.
With the environmental aspect, sulfur recovery more than 160,000 per day as the capacity of the sulfur unit to remove the all pollution from the oil and products of this refinery.
Phase two of the Abadan refinery will include the construction of hydrogen production units, hydrocrackers, a liquefied petroleum gas distillation unit, and ancillary facilities.
Its authorities say once the project comes on stream, the Abadan refinery will turn into an energy hub in the country by 2025. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Abadan.
Ukraine reports a fresh Russian drone strike on its capital as the war is in its 10th month with no end in sight. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine's air defense systems have shot down all 13 drones that targeted Kiev. But according to city officials, two administrative buildings have been damaged. So far, no reports of casualties. In the meantime, fierce fighting continues between the warring sides around the eastern city of Bakhmut. In recent weeks, Russian and Ukrainian troops have intensified their airstrikes. Russia launched the war in February with the aim of demilitarizing its neighbor. Since then, Kiev's Western allies have imposed an unprecedented wave of sanctions on Moscow while providing Ukraine with military aid. Russia says the Western weapons will only prolong the conflict. Staying with Ukraine, the United States will soon be sending its sophisticated Patriot missile system to that country to bolster its air defense against Russian attacks. According to U.S. officials, the decision could be announced as early as Thursday. The plan is awaiting final approval by the U.S. Defense Secretary and the President. So far, there has been no comments from the Pentagon or Ukrainian officials. Kiev has been asking for the system for months. Once finalized, the Patriots will be shipped to Ukraine within days. This will be the most advanced surface-to-air missile system that the West has provided to Ukraine. On Tuesday, the group of seven major economies promised more aid after President Volodymyr Zelensky appealed for more military supplies. Moscow has already warned NATO against delivering Patriots. In all, the U.S. has supplied more than $19 billion in military aid to Ukraine since February.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, European countries have focused their attention on providing support to Kyiv, whether be it financially or militarily. However, Europe's increased concentration on Ukrainian refugees has diverted resources away from other refugee crises around the world. European countries are the largest donors of international aid. In recent years, European nations have been providing 50 billion euros per year to some underdeveloped countries that rely on foreign aid. But since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, the aid embarked for other countries was gradually cut and pumped into the war and the resulting crisis. The European Union has also agreed to add 2.1 billion euros to a fund severely depleted by the military aid for Ukraine in the war against Russia. The so-called European Peace Facility was set up last year to help the EU fund military assistance to its international partners. The fund's original budget of 5.7 billion euros was meant to last until 2027, but has almost completely run dry 10 months into the war in Ukraine. The EU and its member states have so far committed about 8 billion euros of military support to Ukraine against Russia. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, 80% of the people in need of humanitarian aid live in 20 nations. The huge amount of money splurged on Ukraine and Ukrainian refugees has come at the expense of millions others in dire need of healthcare, education, and food across the globe. According to a new report, over 300 million people, half of them children, are in need of desperate aid in some of the world's poorest and most conflict-ridden regions. They have all been deprioritized following the war in Ukraine. For instance, while half of the Somalian population is facing famine, last year the African country was able to receive 68% of its requested funding after a year. Ukraine, though, received the same amount in a matter of 6 weeks. European countries have exhibited double standards regarding sheltering refugees from Ukraine and other nations, giving priority to the former. For example, Denmark holds a hard-nosed stand on Syrian immigrants, but reversed its strict asylum policy only to host Ukrainian refugees. Or in the UK, the government cut all non-essential aid back in 2020, reducing its official development assistance from 0.7% to 0.5%. The Center for Global Development says the reduced aid was spent on housing Ukrainians in the country.
Directing huge amounts of money to Ukraine has left European countries with very little for development in places like Africa. This comes as human rights and anti-war activists say that Western powers are hell-bent on fanning the flames of war in Ukraine as it helps their arms industries flourish.
Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in late February, following Kyiv's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreements and Moscow's recognition of the breakaway Donetsk and Luhansk. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin said one of the goals of what he called a special military operation was to denazify Ukraine. Since the outbreak of the war, Western countries have supplied large consignments of heavy weaponry to Ukraine, with the U.S. topping the chart of supplies despite Russia's repeated warnings that it would only prolong the war. In terms of overall spending on direct military support to Ukraine, the U.S. has committed $18.5 billion, far more than any other country. Germany, the U.K. and Poland have pledged second, third and fourth largest amounts to the war-ravaged country, prompting many to argue that they seek to drag the war. Russian ambassador to the U.S. Anatoly Antonov said last month that Washington sought to prolong the conflict to reap profit from its sale of military equipment and liquefied natural gas to European countries. However, according to reports, as the war intensifies, the arsenals are increasingly depleting, particularly in the U.S. Russian President Vladimir Putin has earlier criticized Western states' policies, warning that they are increasing the risk of a global conflict. Putin also accused the West of exploiting Ukraine and using its people as cannon fodder against Russia. Moscow has repeatedly denounced the West's military support for Ukraine since the war began. The Kremlin says Western countries are only adding fuel to the flames of war, adding that they do not seek to find a solution to end the conflict.
The Brazilian president-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has accused the far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro of inciting violence in the country. The accusation comes one day after pro-Bolsonaro protesters torched vehicles, clashed with police, and tried to invade their headquarters in the capital, Brasilia. Monday's violence came after Brazil's top electoral court officially certified Lula as the winner of the October elections. Lula slammed Bolsonaro for not recognizing his defeat. He said that Bolsonaro is acting like a, quote, fascist. Bolsonaro supporters have been protesting ever since his loss in the October runoff. They've blocked roads and are calling for a military intervention to keep Bolsonaro in power. The outgoing president has asked the protesters to end the blocking. Bolsonaro, however, has encouraged what he calls legitimate protests. Turning now to Peru, where ousted President Pedro Castillo will have to remain in detention for a lot longer, despite nationwide protests calling for his release. Court has rejected Castillo's appeal for freedom, with the prosecutors filing a request to hold him in pretrial detention for 18 months. Castillo is facing charges of rebellion and conspiracy. He has denied those accusations. During his last hearing on Tuesday, Castillo called on police forces to stop killing people who are thirsty for justice. So far, at least seven people have lost their lives during protests calling for his release. Meanwhile, the former vice president, who replaced Castillo as Peru's president a week ago, has promised to work with Congress to hold snap elections. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts say UK recession could turn into a lost decade. The UK faces a lost decade of growth if action isn't taken to address the slumping business investment and worker shortages. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg noted, the UK is facing a fresh wave of industrial turmoil as Rishi Sunak's government refuses to boost pay offers for large numbers of public sector workers, arguing that to do so would drive the nation's double-digit inflation rate even higher. The disputes over pay are just the tip of the iceberg for the Prime Minister. The British people are facing the biggest drop in living standards on record. Essential services like transport and healthcare are crumbling, and the country's mounting interest payments are squeezing public finances despite taxes at the highest in 70 years. One faction in his governing Conservative Party argues that Sunak has resigned himself to the UK's economic decline and is simply trying to manage that process. Those lawmakers want bolder action to revive growth, but their champion Liz Truss and her chance to execute on that plan and comprehensively messed it up. The result is growing anger and unrest among the British workforce. A two-day train operators' strike starts very soon. Planned walkouts this week include driving examiners, Royal Mail postal workers, bus drivers, highway workers, and ground handling staff at Heathrow Airport. The UK is in the grip of the sharpest drop in living standards on record. Most worrying for Sunak is when Royal College of Nursing staff strike for the first time in their history. The government is seeking to face down the strikes, threatening tough new legislation to restrict stoppages and preparing to call in the army to help run essential services. With the opposition Labour Party riding high in polls, Britain's worst industrial strife since 1980s is a key test for Sunak less than 2 months into his premiership. There are worrying echoes from history for the government after 12 years in power and an election looming. Industrial action in 1970s swept away an exhausted Labour government and ushered Margaret Thatcher into office. Meanwhile, Guardian noted UK facing tough road as recession looms despite economy growing in October as it happened. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt warns economy likely to get worse before improving after UK GDP rose 0.5% in October but shrank by 0.3% in the August-October quarter. China Daily also wrote, as Britain's economic crisis spreads from spiraling inflation and high cost of living to weak productivity, experts believe the negative impact of Brexit has become more evident after initially being masked by the COVID-19 pandemic. In its recent economic and fiscal outlook analysis, the Office for Budget Responsibility said that Brexit will result in the UK's trade intensity being 15% lower in the long run than if the UK had remained in the European Union. Trade intensity measures an economy's integration with the world economy. The new research by the London School of Economics found that leaving the EU had already cost UK consumers a total of £5.8 billion over the 2 years up to the end of 2021, adding an average of £210 to household food bills. Jim O'Neill, a leading British sinologist and former UK Treasury Minister, said that while the UK faced the same headwinds globally, COVID-19, energy price developments, the splintering of global governance and climate change policies, it had two huge homemade dilemmas, weak productivity and Brexit. He added, I think it looks clearer and clearer that Brexit is a legitimate reason why the UK is struggling. It is struggling both because of our very weak export performance to our biggest market, the EU, and significant labour shortages in so many sectors of UK economy. Aside from Russia, the UK is expected to be the worst performer among the world's leading economies in the next 2 years, according to the latest economic outlook analysis by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The Paris-based organization has forecast that the UK's GDP will fall by 0.4% in 2023 and rise by 0.2% in 2024. Michael Saunders, a senior economic advisor at Oxford Economics, said Brexit has weakened the UK economy significantly since 2019, along with effects from the pandemic and energy price shock. Saunders pointed out that the UK's business investment had underperformed compared with other major economies since 2016. Reduced trade intensity is bad for long-run productivity growth. Brexit is likely to be a continued drag on the UK economy in coming years, he added. John Burney, vice chair of research at the Asian Development Bank Institute, a think tank, said, once the effects of the pandemic and the Ukraine situation gradually dissipate, global trade will eventually recover. This will further expose the effects of Brexit on the UK's economic trajectory, given the constraints to engage fully in global trade recovery. Burney said he believed this also had indirect effects on other parts of the economy, amplifying labour market frictions and productivity concerns and hampering potential output. Inflation in the UK hit a 41-year high of 11.1% in October on the back of rising energy and food prices. In an effort to tackle the cost of living crisis and rebuild the economy, Jeremy Hunt, the country's Chancellor of the Exchequer, outlined a £55 billion package of tax increases and spending cuts for the UK, which he said would allow inflation and interest rates to be significantly lower. However, Dave Ramsden, Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, said at a recent conference at King's College London that tax increases and spending cuts announced by Hunt were unlikely to persuade the central bank to moderate a future increase in interest rates. Experts agree that over the medium term, the fiscal consolidation measures announced will help to alleviate debt sustainability concerns, but that this is not enough to put the UK's economic growth on track. These measures aim to ensure that public finances will return to a sustainable path, even if economic trend remains sluggish, Saunders said, adding, but the autumn statement did not really contain significant measures to address the UK's poor underlying economic performance. The cuts to public investment will probably make it harder to lift medium-term growth trends. O'Neill said the UK desperately needed a different framework, what you might call a more imaginative and modern golden rule to allow more ambitious government investment spending. It is the only way to really get out of our low productivity and investment trap, he said. The UK recession is expected to span a two-year period from the third quarter of 2022 until the second quarter of 2024. A peak in the tightening interest rate cycle and shift in the projected outlook for inflation could signal a turning point for the trajectory of the economy, whereby policy objectives would gradually pivot from combating inflation toward stimulating growth, Bernie said. Saunders said the economy could get some support if, as futures markets imply, wholesale energy prices drop over the next couple of years. However, the economy's underlying medium-term growth trend is unlikely to improve unless the government introduces a series of supply-side strategy consisting of, say, closer trade links with Europe, higher public investment, and increased spending on education, skills, and infrastructure.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are focusing our discussions on the first and the second sermons, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the conditions prior to the coming of the prophets. And this is important for us to recognize the fact that the prophets came for a reason, for a purpose, to solve a problem, to fill a vacuum, to cure a disease that the society was facing. And we say that the greatest disease of that time was the state of confusion and spiritual lack of understanding in terms of spirituality. So this was there, and the prophets came to remove the communities from that. And Imam Ali alayhi salam beautifully says, in these statements, he says, "Fi fitanin dasathum bi akhfafiha." These were those types of confusions and those types of, you can say, tribulations that the communities were facing, in a way that they were stomping the people with their feet. Like these problems, these tribulations were actually crushing the people under their feet. وَطِئَتْهُمْ بِأَظْلَافِهَا وَقَامَتْ عَلَى سَنَابِكِهَا. And they were stepping them and stomping them, and the hooves of these tribulations and these confusions were crushing and grinding the people. So this is showing the gravity of the situation and the problem that the communities were facing at that time.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we notice that Imam Ali alayhi salam draws a very dark picture of the people before the coming of the messengers and the prophets. And though some may argue that, you know, in the material sense, the communities to a certain degree were thriving, apparently. Yes, there was a rich class and a poor class, but the rich class was quite rich and quite strong. But Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying these people are not realizing that they were actually being crushed under the hooves of these confusions. There were just a few people benefiting materially, but the soul of the community, the actual real and true growth was not happening. And that is actually a very, very, very difficult, a very difficult problem that the communities were definitely facing at that time. فَهُمْ فِيهَا تَائِهُونَ حَائِرُونَ. These were people who were inside that situation and they were completely confused and they were completely in a state of disorientation. And that meant that there was no direction in which they were going, and it was just about enjoying, maybe it was just about living for the sake of living and eating for the sake of eating and growing for the sake of growing and material progress for the sake of material progress, if there was any. And that meant that the community would reach a state of stagnation because there was no actual purpose beyond that issue that they were already having. And you know, this is actually a very big problem. And many of the scholars have discussed this. When a community reaches that level, they know that that community is about to get destroyed because it has reached that ideal that it wanted to achieve. And after that, it doesn't have anywhere to go. The vertical growth has stopped. The horizontal growth also will only be possible if everyone is on board, and it's not real growth, and therefore the community will crumble very soon. And the problem was that these people who are creating, the ones that were running the show, those that had the power and authority in their hands, they were not allowing the communities to recognize their purpose. They were not allowing the communities to have that understanding about their own nature, the fitrah, that innate nature that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided everyone with and has created everyone with. And the innate nature that exists in the societies that want to grow in a spiritual sense, that was something that the leaders and the elders who had things in their hands were not allowing the communities to realize, and that was causing a state of denigration in those communities.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we notice that in these situations where people were in a state of confusion, the devilish and satanic forces were, it was in their interest basically to continue, to allow the people to be continuously in the state of darkness and to fool people and let them just enjoy this little bit of material, pleasures of this world so that they can continue to do what they want to do. And when this is the situation, we see what Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Fi khayri darin wa sharri jiranin." A community is formed whereby the neighbors are the worst of neighbors, but the houses are very good houses. Okay, the houses might be very good, but what's the use of a good house if you don't have a good neighbor? What is the use of good spiritual, good material amenities, but no good relationships with people outside, no solid, firm relationships? And therefore, and we notice that sometimes in many of the communities of the world today that have progressed materially, even today, we see that maybe materially people are wealthy. They have their homes, they have everything. But when you notice and you dissect their social life, you notice that their social life is in wrecks. And this is the result of that confusion, because there is nothing to guide those social relationships. There is nothing to strengthen those ideals of the society. This is something that really we need to contemplate about. Inshallah, we'll discuss this in the coming session because it needs a little bit of more deliberation. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the U.S., a recount in Massachusetts has flipped the state house election to Democrat by just a single vote. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and gives us more details. A recount in a political race in Massachusetts has flipped a state House of Representatives election from Republican to Democrat by just a single vote. Democrat Kristen Kastner won against her Republican opponent and five-term incumbent Lenny Mira earlier this week after a recount that shrunk the candidate's narrow vote deficit to just one. The candidates were all vying for a seat based in the North Shore area, which is a coastal region between Boston and New Hampshire. Prior to the recount, Lenny Mira led Christine Kastner by just 10 votes out of over 23,000 ballots that were cast in that region during the 8th of November midterm election. The 10-vote deficit was within the legal threshold for a recount. On 30th of November, Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin ordered hand recounts in a general area where Lenny Mira held a slim advantage. After officials recounted the votes in question on Thursday, the results emerged as 11,763 to 11,762. Kristen Kastner was ahead by the slightest of margins. In response to that outcome, Lenny Mira said that he will absolutely challenge the result, the Boston Globe reported. Some ballots were filled out in pencil, some were filled out with different coloured ink, some had stray marks. Some had a name written in the write-in and then an oval filled out, the outlet reported him saying. Meanwhile, Christine Kastner believes that there was no foul play in the voting process, saying, "I feel the process unfolded like it should. We'll see what comes when it comes," the Boston Globe reported. "We're not suspicious of anything that ever happened. The recount was just to ensure that between humans and machines we really caught every vote and that was counted," Christine Kastner told CBS. "We thank the tremendous outpouring of people that really got involved and mobilized to go through this process this weekend. It's really a true test of democracy." The new results will go to Governor Charlie Baker for a gubernatorial council for review. Should the recount go unchanged, Democrats will hold 133 of the 160 House districts come next January, again in 4 more seats compared to what they started the last session with at the beginning of 2021. In 2020, Massachusetts offered temporary mail-in voting for the first time as a result of the coronavirus pandemic precautions. Earlier this year, lawmakers voted to make permanent mail-in voting and expanded early voting, two measures which Lenny Mira and the rest of the Republican House caucus voted against. The measures were nevertheless signed into law by Governor Charlie Baker this summer. CBS News has also covered the same story, giving us more details. Democrat Christine Kastner jumped into the lead over five-term Republican Representative Lenny Mira after a district-wide recount erased her narrow deficit and put her ahead by just a single vote, an infinitesimally tight outcome that the incumbent plans to challenge in a court of law. Lenny Mira led Christine Kastner by just 10 votes out of more than 23,000 cast across the North Shore district in the original certified results for the November 8 midterm election, a margin well within the legal threshold that allowed her to file for a recount. By the time Topsfield officials finished retabulating ballots on Thursday from their town's first precinct, the final batch to be counted, the overall result flipped and put Christine Kastner up 11,763 to Lenny Mira's 11,762. Lenny Mira said he plans to challenge the outcome, which would further extend a month-long stretch of uncertainty about who will be the next representative for the redrawn North Shore District of Massachusetts. "It will be absolutely a legal challenge," Lenny Mira said. 5 voters picked other candidates in the race between Kastner and Mira, and 638 left that field blank on their ballots, Secretary of State William Galvin's office said. Christine Kastner picked up 10 votes in Ipswich, 4 votes in Rowley, 3 votes in Topsfield, a net single vote in Newbury, and just 1 vote in Georgetown, according to data provided by Galvin's office. Lenny Mira added a net 5 votes in Ipswich, 3 votes in Topsfield, and 1 in Newbury, while losing a vote in Rowley. "We are not suspicious of anything that ever happened. The recount was just to ensure that between humans and machines we really caught every vote that was counted," Christine Kastner, a Hamilton resident who previously worked as planning director for the town of Burlington, said. She added, "We thank the tremendous outpouring of people that really got involved and mobilized to go through this process this weekend. It's really a true test of democracy." If the result holds, it would reflect another blow for Republicans who lost every Massachusetts statewide race, including the coroner office, and expand the gains Democrats made to their legislative supermajority this cycle. The updated results will now go to Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker and a Governor's Council, which does not plan to meet again until Wednesday for recertification. Lenny Mira, a Georgetown Republican, said attorneys for both sides challenged or questioned several dozen votes during the recount. Only ballots protested at a time during a recount can then be challenged in a court of law. Yesterday in Rowley, they were able to use 5 spoiled ballots that all went to my opponent. In no other town did they let us use spoiled ballots, he said, adding that there were several other mail-in votes in Ipswich for which he believes signatures do not match their envelopes. A battle in a court of law over the validity of individual ballots could thrust the state's voting reforms into the spotlight. Massachusetts rolled out widespread mail-in voting for the first time in 2020, albeit on a temporary basis. In an attempt to ensure that ballot processes, while minimizing the risk of COVID-19 transmission at polling stations. Lawmakers then moved this summer to make that option, as well as expanded early voting, permanent features.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha. on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Here on Hadith of the Day, we would like to recite for our esteemed listeners a very beautiful and noble hadith, which has been transmitted from Imam Ali alayhi salam. This hadith is concerned with the reason why God tests and examines his servants. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been reported to have said, "The greater the ordeal and test, the greater the reward and recompense. The harsher the test, the graver the test, the more difficult the test, the greater will be the reward and recompense, which is handed out after the test is successfully passed." Then Imam Ali said, "Do you not see that Allah, the praiseworthy, tested our precursors from the time of Adam, peace be upon him, to the last generations in this world? He tested them with what? He tested them with the creation of stones that neither harm nor benefit them." Meaning, he tested them with false beliefs. He placed in front of them idolatry. In their time, there was, you know, idolatry was rampant. People were idolaters. They believed in polytheism. They didn't believe in tawhid, right? This was a test for these prophets. Allah wanted to see, would they believe in such false beliefs, or would they adhere to tawhid and monotheism and the true religion? "And he made from them his sacred house, which he made a standing place for people. But Allah tries his servants with various ordeals and obligates them with various forms of struggle, and test them with various dreads, fears." You know, he tests us with the things that we are afraid of. "Why does he do this?" The Imam says, "In order to eradicate vanity from their hearts and instill in humility in their souls. When we are put through tests and we're tried in various ways and tried through various tribulations and trials, it humbles us." It humbles us, you know, and, you know, the pride and arrogance that was once in our heart is eradicated from it. Then the Imam said, "And that this may open the doors to his favor and the feasible means to his forgiveness." Once we pass these tests with flying colors, so to speak, right, Allah will shower his blessings on us. He will forgive us for our sins, the sins that we had committed. Right? So trials are, first of all, a means of a precursor to the handing out of rewards. It's also a way to instill humility in the hearts of the servants and eradicate vanity from it. It's also a way in which God finalizes in his judgment on the person. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the reason for God's testing his servants in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.